Hey there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that is continuing to walk through Dante's masterwork comedy that has gotten itself way into Purgatorio. In fact, we're coming toward the middle, well, a little past the middle, of the first terrace of Purgatory proper, past the gate of Purgatory and the angel who sits there. We're at Purgatorio Canto 11, and we're going to finish it off at lines 109 through 139. We're going to meet a third figure here on the Terrace of Pride. We have met one scion of a noble family, shall we say, and we've met an artist, and now we're going to meet somebody else. In fact, we're not going to actually meet him. We're just going to hear about him from that artist, Odorisi. If you'd like to read along, you can find this translation on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. You can print it off. You can make notes with the print off. And even more than that, you can continue the conversation with me if you'd like to talk about this episode, disagree, offer alternative perspectives, all that kind of stuff. We can get to a long debate about what happens here because it's a bit murky, as you'll see. The end of Purgatorio, Canto 11, lines 109 through 139. As to the one who's going along so slowly in front of me, Odorisi said, all of Tuscany resounded with his fame, although he's now barely whispered about in Siena. He was a ruler there when they knocked apart the Florentine insolence, a city as full of pride at the time as she is a whore now. Your name recognition is the color of the grass, which comes and goes. It loses its color because of the very one that makes it spring from the earth. And I replied to him, the truth you speak truly infuses my heart with benevolent humility. It lances a great swelling there. But who is the guy you talked about right now? That guy, Odorisi replied, is Provenzan Salvani. He's here because he was so presumptuous that he thought he'd get all of Siena in his hands. That's why he walks on without rest, just as he has since he died. He pays back his debt in similar coinage to the way he was back in the day. And I said, if a spirit who holds off praying for his repentance until the edge of life has to stay down below and cannot come up here for as many hours as he had on earth, unless good prayers help him ascend, how was that guy allowed to get up here? When he was still alive in his greatest glory, Odorisi said, he willingly sat in Siena's campo and put aside all of his shame. There, to pay the price for his friend who was held in Charles's prison, he was reduced to quaking in every vein of his body. I won't say anything else. Understand that what I've said is obscure, but it won't be long before your townsmen will act in a way that you'll be able to gloss my words. This deed brought him beyond those confines. Tough passage about ante-purgatory. We're looking back at it and explaining how this guy's not down there and how he's up here, somehow ending up with Dante himself. We want to talk about Provenzan Salvani, a major figure who has much known about him in the historical record, and in fact, another tie back to Inferno, a tie back, in fact, directly to Ferinata. I'm telling you, the heretics are running around in these cantos of the prideful in Purgatorio. And we want to talk about some interesting interpretive conundrums in this passage, as well as some of the medieval Florentine, which is just so gorgeous and deserves our attention. Let's start out with the first nine lines. As to the one who's going along so slowly in front of me, this is Odorisi speaking, all of Tuscany resounded with his fame, although he's now barely whispered about in Siena. We know this bit, that you don't last very long here on earth. I'm laughing because there's a great book called Sum, S-U-M, 39 Tales, I think, of the Afterlife, something like that, Tales of the Afterlife, Sum, S-U-M. And it's all about what happens to you after you die. And there's 39, I think, different perspectives on that. And in one of the perspectives or stories about the afterlife, everybody is forced to wait in an airport waiting lounge until the last time their names are spoken on Earth. So there's a departing plane and you can board, but you can't board until the last time your name is spoken on Earth. And so some people like Aristotle and Plato are just really peeved. They are so angry that they can't board this plane. Because they're being remembered. Well, anyway, we know this bit about the passing away of fame, and this guy's clearly another node in that story we've been told. Odorizzi goes on. He was a ruler there when they knocked apart the Florentine insolence, a city as full of pride at the time as she is a whore now. Your name recognition is the color of the grass, which comes and goes. It loses its color because of the very one that makes it spring from the earth. There's a couple things I want to note here before we talk about the Florentine insolence, and they mostly have to do with what's in the medieval Florentine. One is this name recognition function, nominanza, in the medieval Florentine. This is a really interesting term. It's not just fame, but it is, as I said, the notability of your name, the way your name is called. Your name is as the color of grass. So it's not just what you've done, but kind of your very essence, if you think especially about naming in a medieval or even in a biblical context. It says that the color of the grass fades out because of the very one that makes it spring from the earth. Well, this would be the sun. The sun causes in the spring the grass to grow. And then as the season goes on, as you well know, the sun starts to brown the grass. This gives a natural quality to what's happening here. Now, you should know this bit about the fading color of the grass is almost cliched. It's aphoristic at this point. It occurs multiple times throughout the Bible, mostly in what Christians call the Old Testament or in the Jewish scriptures. By using it here, we're saying that the loss of your name recognition is natural, that there's something about this cyclical pattern that is built into the way things happen. Now, we would jump out, I'm sure, if we knew Christian theology and talk about the fall. But for now, let's just say that something's happening on Earth that causes this ebb and flow of name recognition. Then, one more thing in the Florentine, it's that bit that Florence was a city as full of pride at one time as she is a whore now. This is very coarse language from Purgatorio. This is a little bit of Inferno sitting here in Purgatorio. And we're going to have more of Inferno in Canto 12 just ahead of us. It's interesting that these nodes of Inferno keep popping up here, a note of the diction, this coarse, vulgar language, and in the next canto, an actual reference to Inferno itself. It's all sitting below us, and we should remember that that was quite a magnificent task on Dante's part to write Inferno, and we shouldn't be surprised that its resonances creep in here. It's ironic that they creep in a passage about how things naturally pass away. Inferno is not so naturally passing away. It's still raising its head here, even in Purgatorio, with crude diction like this. Let's talk about what is going on here with the Florentine insolence. The reference here is to the Battle of Monteperti in 1260, in which the Sienese Ghibellines put to rout the Florentine Guelphs. And if you just think about this, this passage on the terrace of the Prideful is really interesting in terms of who we meet being crushed under these rocks, because we met a while back Umberto Aldobrandesco, and his family is part of a storied past that they had been Ghibellines, and then they became Guelphs, and they were part part, signatories, in the disastrous 1254 treaty between Siena and Florence that ultimately led to the bloodbath of the Battle of Monteperti. What we can see here is that Tuscan history is surrounding Odorici. And if we just step back and think about this, we have one figure from a slightly earlier time in Tuscan history, the peace treaty between Siena and Florence. Then we have an artist, and then we have this figure who is actually part of the Battle of Monteperti. We'll talk more about that in a minute. So the artist is set in the middle of this strife, and we can make two conclusions from that, or two potential conclusions. One, that art keeps going no matter the political strife, or two, that art is in fact surrounded by the strife, is a way out of the strife, is a different way to look at the world. It's just obviously structurally important that Dante began our look at those crushed under rocks with somebody who preceded slightly the Battle of Monteperti, and now we get somebody who clearly was a great ruler. He was a ruler when they knocked apart the Florentine insolence. The Sienese knocked them apart. This brings up the question of the kinds of pride here on the Terrace of Pride. So let's stop and talk about that for a minute. This notion that there are different kinds of pride punished here or paid back, I shouldn't say punished because it's not really punished. We'll talk more about that in a minute. The notion that there are different kinds was first raised by Dante's own son, Pietro, in one of his constantly amended commentaries on his father's work. And what he says, and I think we should kind of accept this for a moment, is that Umberto, that first guy we met, is an example of pride of caste or pride of privilege. I came from a really noble family and I take a lot of pride in my caste, in my estate, in my titled privilege. And then we came across Odorici and we had pride of talent. And now we have pride of power or pride of position, not hereditary caste privilege of a titled family, but somebody who rose to power. Siena was a republic, and this figure was a citizen of the republic and rose to power rather than being granted it through a noble titled family. Pride of caste, pride of talent, and pride of power. In other words, what we're looking at here is scholastic divisions. We're seeing Dante do essentially Thomistic theology on pride, not exactly in the way St. Thomas Aquinas would do it, but in the spirit of scholastic thought, where you take something and you divide it into subdivisions. And I'll bet if you thought about this, if you just step back from the passage and thought about it, you could come up with different ways to look at Umberto Odorici and this Salvani fellow. You could think about different ways that pride is, focused, localized, the way it's brought into point of view in the three figures, that might show differences of sorts of pride among them. Before we get to Salvani himself, let's just look at what Dante the Pilgrim says. So Dante hears all of this about this guy was part of the forces that knocked down the Florentine insolence. As I said, that's the Battle of Monteperti in 1260. And Dante replies, "The truth you speak truly infuses my heart with benevolent humility. It lances a great swelling there in the Florentine, a grand tumor, a big tumor." This is yet another confession. We've seen one already, and here's another one, of Dante's guilt or debt in pride. There's some way that Dante is distinctly connected to pride. We can't go very far back, right, to the thieves and saying, "I can do better than Lucan and Ovid," to say our poet must have a weak spot with pride. But what I want to point out here is not the swelling of pride and the lancing of it, but the phrase that comes before it, "The truth you speak truly infuses my heart with benevolent humility." In the medieval Florentine, that phrase is "tuo vero dir, min cora bono umilta." Let me just pull that apart for you. Your true words, tuo vero dir, to speak. So speaking your truth. And then comes this wild phrase, min cora bona umilta. It's so beautiful. It enheartens me with good humility, or good humility enheartens me. Incora. Mincora, that's the M apostrophe me. Mincora bona umilta. So poetically gorgeous from the pilgrim that your heart is infused. That's the way I translated it, but it's really untranslatable. It's inheartens, but not with an E-N, with an I-N. Inhearts. Good humility inhearts me. It somehow becomes part of my heart, part of the interior of my heart, part of the insides of my heart. It's so wonderfully said, so poetic, so collapsed and condensed, but beautifully stated. Min cora bona umilta. I had to stop and say, wow, gorgeous poetry. All right. Now, having done that, let's see about this guy that Orisi is talking about. Orisi replies, that guy is Provenzano Salvani. Now, I want to stop right here. Maybe in his own day, Provenzano. But in our text, it says Provenzano Salvani. Who is this? All right, let's back up. As I already told you, Siena was a republic, not necessarily a landed titled estate. So Salvani was a citizen, and he rose to great power. We have a lot about him and his various positions in Siena throughout the 1250s, 1260s, essentially, by the time we get up to the Battle of Montaperti, Salvani is in control almost as a dictator of Siena. He then also extends his power post-Montaperti. He becomes the podesta, or the mayor, as we've kind of said before, the podesta of Montepulciano in 1261, and then he becomes the podesta of Arezzo in 1262, but he never actually assumes that position. He is finally killed by the Florentine Guelphs in retaliatory attacks in 1269. He's taken and beheaded. But this guy is a very prominent Ghibelline leader. In fact, so prominent that we have to go back to Farinata in Inferno. When Farinata says, I spoke out against the destruction of Florence, he's talking about Provenzano Salvani, who is the one who wanted to raise Florence to the ground after the Battle of Monteperti. And one of the troubling, intriguing, interesting, curious questions of comedy is, why is Farinata damned in Inferno? And this guy, who wanted to do real harm to Florence, why is he saved in Purgatorio? Now, there's an answer that's going to lie down in this passage about quaking in every vein. That may be Dante's shading of the material. We could have easily imagined a moment in which Farinata, I don't know, on his deathbed turns and repents and Dante saves him. That the guy who saved Florence is damned and the guy who wanted to raise it to the ground is saved is one of the true curiosities of comedy. Orisi goes on, that's why he walks on without rest, just as he did since he died. He pays back his debt in similar coinage to the way he was back in the day. We've already seen this once in lines 70 through 72 in this canto, that there is a debt being repaid. And this is what's so intriguing. We're very close to contrapasso here. Remember in Inferno when we talked about how the damned are punished and there's a contrapasso, there's somehow punished in a way that reflects their great sin, so that when that term comes up amongst the schismatics, we find out that they are being carved up by that demon as they walk around their Malabolgia, and thus the contrapasso, or the hypocrites in their gilded leaden cowls. Again, contrapasso. Well, we've got something pretty close to contrapasso here. The prideful are bent down under rocks. But Dante is pretty intent on changing the metaphor. It's not contrapasso type for type, against the passage, against the happening, with the happening, on spot with the happening, like that. Instead, it's debt. in Purgatorio, Dante is still working with this contrapasso metaphor, this contrapasso technique, but he wants us to understand that it's the payment of a debt, that in hell there's no way to pay that debt back. But in purgatory, there's a way to pay it back based on your actions before you die. So what is a proclivity, what is a sin, changes into a debt based on your repentance, and you can pay back debts if you work at it. This is hair splitting at its best. But we can see Dante trying to tell us it's different in purgatory than it is in hell. I may look at it and say, well, it's the same to me. But Dante is trying to get us to understand the difference, and we should honor that. As I have said a million times, we have to deal with the poem we are given. So Dante replies, and I said, if a spirit who holds off praying for his repentance until the edge of life has to stay down below and cannot come up here, that's what he learned from Balaqua, that you've got to spend as much time in antepurgatory as you spent being negligent or not repenting down on earth. So Dante knows this from having heard it. For as many hours as he had on earth, as he continues to explain, unless good prayers help him to ascend, as he continues to explain, thus all those in antepurgatory saying, get people to pray for me. How was that guy allowed to get up here? What's interesting here is that there is a bigger question of logistics in Purgatorio than there is in Inferno. And I think that this is something we should just stop and talk just a second about. In Inferno, it was almost assumed that the damned deserve what they get. Listen, this is not my metaphysics. This is not my theology. This is not my ethics. But if we take the poem we're given, in Inferno, the damned deserve what they get. Here, it's a different matter. And here we have to work out, wait a minute, now what is this? This is not, in fact, punishment because this is the way you were in life, thieves, hypocrites, falsifiers, heretics, etc. This has been changed into a debt that you can repay back, and how does that work? And if you have to stay down there, how did this guy get up here and he repented late and blah, blah, blah. And this emphasis on logistics shows us that purgatory is a fairly new doctrine. Hell? Not so much. Hell's been around since at least the visions of the apocalypse of St. Peter and St. Paul, and even before that in biblical records. Purgatory? New territory. And so you can see Dante working out the logistics here, worrying about the logic of this. Oh, Balaqua said we got to wait around and many hours as we spend on earth without repenting. So how does that work here? And Manfred said 7 years for every year we were excommunicated. How does that work? You can see Dante teasing this out. And I think that teasing out shows us how new this doctrine of purgatory is. We got to figure out the logistics of it. And part of it is that what we now understand as purgatory is partially being created by our poet. Yes, by the theologians around him, of course, but partially by our poet himself. And so we can see this greater emphasis on how exactly does this work. If you are enjoying this episode of the podcast, Walking with Dante, let me say it would be great if you could help support this podcast. I have lots of licensing, hosting, editing, website fees, domain fees. It just goes on and on. If you'd like to help out, there is a PayPal link both in the player for this podcast and, in fact, on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. You can give what you will, and I would really appreciate your help in supporting this podcast. If you don't, no worries and no shade. We're going to keep walking up this very steep mountain. Odorici finishes off. He explains how to get here. When he was alive in his greatest glory, and that would, be when Salvani was, you know, really at the height of his powers. He's becoming podesta of other cities. He's basically a dictator in Siena. I mean, at the very height of his power, he willingly sat in Siena's campo and put aside all of his shame there to pay the price for his friend who was held in Charles's prison. And he was reduced to quake shaking in every vein of his body. You should just know that what happens right now is a little unclear. It's interesting that we know so much about Provin Sansalvani and so much about his rise to political power and so much about his play at the Battle of Monteperdi and so much about his position versus Farinata's post-bloodbath. We know all of that, and this is something that's a little murky. Early commentators claim that one of Salvani's friends was captured at Tagliacozza in 1268, that's a year before Salvani dies, by Charles of Anjou's forces. Charles of Anjou knew that he had one of Salvani's great friends, and so Charles of Anjou demanded a ransom of 10,000 florins. And Salvani had basically bankrupted Siena in its wars, its many wars, and then its follow-up campaigns, one of which actually took his own life. Salvani has basically emptied the treasury, and there was no money. So, according to the early commentators, Salvani put on sackcloth and ashes and sat in that famous big campo of Siena that is so gorgeous. Oh, my gosh. Such a gorgeous place. Sat in that famous campo square, the center of Siena, sat there begging for the money in sackcloth and ashes. That is a story told, but we can't verify it. We know that the commentators are adding it. Are they adding it here to make sense of this? Maybe. This is how we know, though, for sure, that whatever was wrong with Salvani, his pride, has been turned into a debt because he humbled himself to beg money for a friend. Now, this is interesting. If you just step back from it, say, he didn't humble himself before God. Odorici, the illuminator, clearly told us he humbled himself before God before he died. But this is not necessarily before God. This is on behalf of a friend, which automatically makes it a little weird. Is doing something for a friend the same as doing it for God? Well, Jesus would say so in the New Testament. But is Dante thinking that? Interesting little theological conundrum that happens here. And again, a little murky in the historical record. We can say the early commentators claim this, but we don't actually have any historical proof that this is what happened. But this leads Odorici out to an even bigger question. He finishes off the canto. I won't say anything else. Understand that what I've said is obscure. So, you know, when Purgatorio is allegedly happening, the journey is happening in the year 1300, he's saying to the pilgrim, you're not going to get this. You're not going to understand the whole sackcloth and ashes thing and begging. But it won't be long before your townsmen, the Florentines, will act in a way that you'll be able to gloss my words. In other words, he's predicting Dante's exile. He's saying, pretty soon, buddy, you're going to be reduced to quaking in every vein until it doesn't look like you're such a big shot. And this is yet another way that the heretics are rumbling around here. Because remember, Farinata also predicts Dante's exile, just as Odorici does here. Though again, the heretics in Inferno 10 and into the first part of Canto 11 are rolling around here in Purgatorio 10, 11, and 12, as we will see to come. And we should say one more thing about this prophecy of Dante's exile, just one little bit. If Salvani did this deed and sat around in sackcloth and ashes, if that's true, and that this is now a predictor of Dante's exile, does this mean that Dante also won't have to spend any time in ante-purgatory? It seems to be a conclusion we can draw. Salvani was humbled. Dante's about to be humbled. Salvani then got out of ante-purgatory. Is Dante going to get out of ante-purgatory too because he's going to be humbled in exile? It seems to be sitting there as an implication at the back of the passage, but it is certainly not explored. It is just implied. There's a last and final point in this long passage that is incredibly interesting, and let's just land there. Odorici says, it won't be long before your townsmen will act in a way that you'll be able to gloss my words. Here it comes. Ready? You know I'm going to say this. Life glosses art, and not the other way around.
I'm saying something to you here as an artist in a constructed fictional passage, and soon enough, Pilgrim, you're going to have lived through this, and so you're going to understand my words. So we're back to that problem of which comes first, art or life, and right here, again, art comes first. The artist speaks. The passage is created, and then you're going to live it, and you're going to be able to see what it means. This is that high-level, theoretical, wildly metatextual point that we got bogged down in the middle of in previous episodes on this terrace when we were looking at the intaglios and the guys then under the rocks who look like columned figures or figures under columns in architectural designs. We're back there again, and it's ending right there in the last lines of Canto 11. Just think about that a minute. You have to imagine it before you can live it, or you have to read it, see it, experience it before you can know it. How do I say this? Let me throw this completely out of Dante. You have to stand in front of the chaos of a Jackson Pollock before you understand that the chaos of life includes rhythm. By learning what a Pollock does on the wall, you then turn back to your life and say, oh, there's a rhythm in the neural chaos that my perceptions bring. Or you read a great work, comedy, and you discover that, in fact, life has an arc toward a solution, as we're heading in Paradiso, that makes sense of that arc. And you turn back to your life and you say, how does my life have an arc? Because you read it here first. Art may actually gloss life. One more time, the end of Purgatorio, Canto 11, lines 109 through 139. As to the one who's going along so slowly in front of me, Odorici said, all of Tuscany resounded with his fame, although he's now barely whispered about in Siena. He was a ruler there when they knocked apart the Florentine insolence, a city as full of pride at the time as she is a whore now. Your name recognition is the color of the grass, which comes and goes. It loses its color because of the very one that makes it spring forth from the earth. And I replied to him, the truth you speak truly infuses my heart with benevolent humility. It lances a great swelling there. But who is this guy you talked about right now? That guy, he replied, is Provenzan Salvani. He's here because he was so presumptuous that he thought he'd get all of Siena in his hands. That's why he walks on without rest, just as he has since he died. He pays back his debt in similar coinage to the way he was back in the day. And I said, if a spirit who holds off praying for his repentance until the edge of life has to stay down below and cannot come up here for as many hours as he had on earth, unless good prayers help him with sin, how is that guy allowed to get up here? When he was alive in his greatest glory, Odorici said, he willingly sat in Siena's campo and put aside all of his shame. There, to pay the price for his friend who was held in Charles's prison, he was reduced to quaking in every vein of his body. I won't say anything else. Understand that what I said is obscure, but it won't be for long before your townsmen will act in a way that you'll be able to gloss my words. This deed brought him beyond those confines. Well, we've come to the end of Canto 11, and it was quite the canto. It was just amazing, the intaglios that we had in 10, and these figures now, so much conversation in 11, so much talking, so quiet in 10, so loud in 11, so many voices coming in every direction from under those rocks. Really wild stuff all the way around from that opening prayer all the way out to this bit about art glossing life. To go on to Canto 12, you need to subscribe to this podcast. And if you would, consider writing a rating. It really helps me if you'll rate this podcast, give it a star rating on whatever platform you're on. And if you'll just take the time to write, even great podcast or having a great time. Otherwise, we are going on to Canto 12. We're stepping on this terrace of pride. We're not off it yet. We got one more canto. But this one has got, yeah, oh yeah, you know it, even more art in it. Put on your glasses, for a lot more to see in the next episodes of Working with Dante. I'm Mark Scarborough. I'll see you then.